This is 3:55 on Friday, October 28th.
Okay, good morning.
More than a third, less than a half. Good. More than a third, less than a half.
No. Sort of like if it were a test score, it would be really bad. And I'm afraid that's what people are setting themselves up for by not being here, is test scores that are really bad. And I'm not inclined to be generous a second time around about opportunities to fix things. So, you know, I'm talking now to the people on the recording, not the people who are in the room, primarily. Yeah. All right. So, any sort of project-related questions at this point? Any investigation of the project, I hope? I know there are other things going on, but really... if you can invest an hour or two and start get your head wrapped around the space early on, I promise you that will be helpful. And failing to do that will be really not helpful. So that's what I'm pushing on. All right, so here we are on Friday the 28th. Next Friday we will do the exam review. The following Monday is exam 2. The following Friday is a holiday. And I'm thinking that on Wednesday the 9th, what we do is have a lab kind of session in class about the project. This is only useful if you have seriously looked at the project ahead of time. And so, what should I do? Have some way to determine that before we actually proceed with a lab session, or I don't know. But in previous years, this has worked really well in some years, and in other years, it has not worked well at all because people have actually looked at the project. Well, I'm thinking about it. So for now, what's scheduled for the day after the exam is a lab session on the project. It'll be 5 days or so before it's due, which gives you a chance to sort of work out any kinks that may be happening, and then on Friday you get the holiday to also work on that. So. All right. Other questions? That was the question I asked for questions about the projects. Other questions about anything? So last time we were talking about network adapters. There we go. Network adapters. And, oh, I have a question. This just occurred to me. When I do the recording, in the video recordings of the class, do you see the slides? I'm in slide presenter mode. Or do you see the blank screen or my screen? We see the slides. Yay. Okay. Yes.
The one thing that you cannot see is when you're pointing at the screen.
Exactly.
Right here.
Well, there's some value. There's some value then to being in class, isn't there? Yes.
I've noted that when I went back. Right where?
Right where? Yes. Right where? Some notes. Okay. Some notes. He was pointing right there when he said that important thing. All right. Okay. Well, we see the slides. I'm not in the habit of pointing with the mouse, and it just doesn't work for me. So there's value in being in class. Link layers implemented in the network interface card, which is in our laptop, sort of embedded inside the system. We can't see it. It's attached to the host, and somehow or other it takes signals from the host buses and turns them into actual
link layer frames, and also sort of the physical layer, right? The network interface device is typically also the thing that makes the electrical signals on the Ethernet cable, the radio signals, and the Wi-Fi, whatever it is.
Okay. And
this is maybe a little bit interesting. The abstract model of this is that the CPU handles some issues associated with the link and network layer and everything associated with transport and communication. People keep trying to push some of this network and transport stuff down into the network interfaces to offload the CPU. From a programming abstraction point of view, it makes no difference at all unless you're building device drivers for these things, in which case then you have to worry about that. So people who build device drivers these days also have to know about network and transport to a certain extent, sometimes, depending. Otherwise, for those of us who can live above that level, we don't worry about it. So, remember, our frames happen on the link layer. They have frame headers, they have frame trailers sometimes, and they have the network datagrams and encapsulation. Same old story. Now, what goes into the frame header and frame trailer? Well, stuff related to managing the link layer, right? So, addresses at the link layer, things like the error correction and detection, which we're about to talk about, how those work. Additional bits associated with that go into the frame layer metadata. If you do flow control at the link layer, you can have some bits for that there.
Nothing, not rocket. That is definitely not rocket science. We're now going to talk to something that is potentially harder than rocket science, but we're not going to talk about the hard parts. We're going to talk about the sort of simplified version of this. But folks, the mathematical principles of the things we're about to talk about can get very complicated indeed. And people who have sort of high-powered math backgrounds work on problems like these in order to make... And what do they accomplish by doing that? They make systems sort of make communication more reliable, more efficient, that sort of thing. Okay. So error detection is the process of turning a message into a somewhat larger message, so that we can determine whether the message has been corrupted from the time it was sent to the time it was received. It's not possible to make error detection 100% reliable. And if you think about this, we'll see why. The idea is that we have our original message, right? And we have a somewhat larger message that is the result of applying the error detection transformation to it. And the way error detection works is we look at this bigger message and we say, is it valid? Well, a lot of bigger messages are valid, not just one. So if there are so many errors that we transform a valid bigger message into another valid bigger message, then we're not able to catch those errors. It's got to be that way. On the other hand, the way that people design these systems is to say, let's try to catch the errors that are likely to occur. And in different link layers, the likely errors are often of different qualitative characteristics, but for example, a single bit being flipped, right, is
probably one of the more likely errors, and we'd definitely like to be able to catch that. Two bits being flipped is two adjacent bits being flipped, or just two bits separated. We might like to be able to catch that. Another really common one is an error where there are a bunch of bits that are all sort of flipped or not in a row. Right? You just sort of impose some noise onto the bits in a small range, and they all get corrupted to a certain extent. Okay, so the scheme is typically take our datagram, append some additional information, and send this larger message over the link where we receive something that we're going to call D prime and EDC prime. You know, hopefully they're the same as D and EDC, but there's no guarantee of that because it's an error channel. So then we test this is kind of the wrong test. The test we actually perform here is this a valid extended message? And if it's a valid extended message, then we're going to assume that D prime is what was originally sent and delivered. If it is not, we will suppress the message, maybe report that an error was detected, and wait for the next one.
By valid, do you just mean that it's the same message as the original DEDC?
No. Right. Remember I said we have this extended set of messages, right? We have our original message, we have the error detection and correction bits that were appended. Some of those are legal, some of those extended messages are legal, and others aren't. Okay? We're going to see an example of what makes it legal and what not. But the point is that we've added a bit of redundancy to this by adding these additional bits so that we can partition the things we receive into things we think are okay and things we think are not okay. And as I said earlier, I mean, D prime might be different from D, and it might still pass if EDC prime was transformed in a corresponding way, right, to give us another longer message that is considered valid. Okay? Well, that's the theory. Questions? So, the very simplest version of this that has been around for, this has been around for probably close to 100 years now, is so-called parity checking. And what we do is we extend our message, our original message, by just one bit, and we make up a rule that says, in this extended message, there have to be, we'll pick a rule.
Even or odd,
and it looks like it's even. So we'll pick even. We'll say our extended rule is in the extended message to be valid, it must have an even number of ones. Number one bits. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Well, if that were the rule, that's
other
like
things.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Well, they used a different rule on this on that side of the cell. So, I don't know what to do now. It's going to be confusing either way. So, okay, on this side of on the left side of the slide, they've chosen the rule that it should be an odd number of one bits. Okay? And so they added a parity bit of 0. Okay? So when this message is received, it will be considered valid if there are an odd number of one bits.
there any reason for choosing one over the other?
No.
Or is it just
none whatsoever. Completely symmetric. Which is why people have a hard time being consistent, I guess, because you can do either one. All right, so half of the messages now are valid and half aren't. If we change some bits over here, we may also have to the parity bit in order to have it still be a valid message. If I just change one bit here, it changes it into an invalid message, even if I change the parity bit, right? If I change any one bit any single bit of the original message extended by the parity bit, then this parity checking scheme will detect that error because it will be an invalid extended message. Okay? I need to move on, unless there's a question. All right. On the right side, they have chosen to do even parity as the rule. And they do even parity in two dimensions. So our message is this followed by this followed by this followed by that. And what we do is we compute the parity for the little chunks individually. And we do that across the rows and down the columns. And build up parity vectors associated with the message, original message. And you can see that it's been done here. So when I get all of this, and presumably what happens is we send this, 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 and then we send this and this, or something like that. So all of that together makes up the extended message that gets received. We rearrange what we receive into this scheme, and we check, do we have even parity in every row and every column? If so, it's treated as a good message. If not, it's a bad message. Furthermore, if there's only one row and one column where if there's exactly one row and one column where parity errors are detected, what do we assume? We assume that the reason for that is that the bit at the intersection of that row and column has been changed, because changing that single bit will fix both parity errors. So that's a simple error detection code that can detect that can correct a single bit error. Okay? So the example of a detection code. Yeah.
Isn't that odd parity?
There's an error if there's four ones.
I don't know. There's an error.
Right.
There's three ones here.
Well,
where is there an error?
Well, there's a one on the column, right?
This is a one.
Yeah. So there's four and there's an error. That would mean that if it was odd, it would not be an error. So that'd be odd parity.
No. This column currently has odd parity.
Right.
And this row currently has odd parity, and those are called errors. This row, which does not have an error, has even parity.
So if both row and column have odd parities, it's an error?
No, it's an error if there are any violations in the rows or the columns. Right? Any error, if there are any errors in any row or any column, it's an error.
Okay.
It's a correctable error if there is exactly one row with an error and exactly one column with an error, in which case we can fix it by changing the bit at the row-column intersection.
Oh.
Okay? But if we change this to a 1, then we have even parity here, and we have...
Okay. I thought you had to sum the number of 1s just because it was intersecting, so I thought it was summing the number of 1s.
Oh, no. You don't ever sum up the number of 1s in the row and the column.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Together. Right. Separately, the row and the column.
Okay.
Okay? All right. Okay.
Well, that's really simple. The int checksum This is a lie. Note used at transport layer only. Used in IPv4 for the header checksum as well. It's the same algorithm. The network header checksum.
Liars.
Hmm?
Liars.
Liars. Yeah. All right. So this is a different algorithm. It's not parity. It adds up all of the 16-bit. You take your message and you chop it up into 16-bit chunks and you add all those up. And it uses, okay, so it's a 16-bit addition with the case that, you know, if you add up multiple 16-bit numbers, you may get more than a 16-bit number. So it does sort of overflow folding back in a particular way and puts the result of all of that as a 16-bit number into the checksum field. Okay. And the only thing that matters, the only variation is whether we're talking about TCP or UDP or the network header, is just how much data is covered by that checksum. And what we do is essentially add up all those fields, and then at the receiver, we check to see whether the sum that we compute over those fields at the receiver agrees with the checksum that's in the pack. And as we said, no scheme like this is perfect. We consider it valid if the checksum matches what we compute as the sum, but we don't actually know that there are no errors. We just have a very high probability. That's the internet checksum. And it's not an error correction code at all. It's a detection code only. Another scheme for doing these is the so-called cyclic redundancy check. And it has really nice properties, which are not listed. And I don't remember. But depending on the size of the so-called generator that we use and the particular value of the generator that we use, we can get properties like it can detect any odd number of errors. Right. So regardless of how many errors there are, if it's odd, we will detect it. If there's a bounded amount of contiguous errors. So a bound on, I have an error here, and if you don't have an error here, I have an error here. If those aren't too far apart, then everything else is good outside of that range. It can detect that. Right? So it's pretty powerful. This general idea can be extended to error correcting codes as well, and that's where the high-powered mathematics comes into play. And indeed, when I was working at IBM back in the early 1980s, that was one of the things that they were doing, hiring these mathematicians to develop codes like this that they would use in the controllers of hard disk drives. So hard disk drives at that point were, you know, a large hard disk drive was 33 megabytes. That was, you know, like this big around in a cabinet. That was 33 megabytes, and they wanted to get more bits onto this, and so you know, a magnetic read head isn't actually a very reliable thing. So they were developing these codes so they write these codes onto the disk, and then the magnetic read head would read back the values, probably with lots of errors, and then they would correct them to be the correct value. So it's a somewhat interesting field of mathematics, but not to me. other people find it interesting. Okay, so how does it work? So we're going to go through an example of this in some detail. So how does it work? Same deal. We have our data bits D.
Somehow or other. Oh, there we go. Very misleading. We don't view it as a binary number. Really, we don't. You'll be confused if you try to think of it as a binary. Think of it as D data bits. We choose a generator, G, which is just an R plus 1 bit pattern. Okay? We'll see why it's R plus 1 in here in a second rather than something else. And then what we do is we go through an algorithm that processes D with G to produce an R bit pattern that will become the so-called cyclic redundant G checksum or checksum. And the way it works is that we do something that looks a lot like division of something related to D by G and end up with this value of R. And so the receiver can go through the same process, and this is a common pattern, right? The sender does something, adds some information that's the result of that computation to the message, sends the whole thing to the receiver. The receiver does the same thing to the message and compares what it gets as an answer to what was included in the message. Okay, so these things are widely used in practice, and let's just go on to the next slide, guys. I'm actually gonna work this out line by line rather than just pointing to it, but I just want to show you the components here. So here's the message that we started with. I think that's on the previous slide. I hope. No. All right. Well, it's labeled here as D, the original message.
Okay? So that's the message for which we want to compute a checksum. The way we do it is we extend it with R zeros. So we just tack R zeros onto the end of it. If you think about what that thing, you might think of that as multiplying that number times 2 to the R. But again, I don't really want to think of it as a number. I want to think of it as a bit string. So you might think of it as shifting that message left by 2 to the R. But by R, yes, whatever. Okay. And then what we do is we do this funny kind of division. It's actually called polynomial division. It's not numerical division. Don't think of this as dividing one binary number by another one, because that's not what is happening. And you will get wrong answers if you do it that way. We're going to use some special rules for this division. So let me write this out now. Go through it step by step. So hopefully my version of this here is the same as on the slide. So here's our D, 101110. Is that the same? I hope. And here are, so this is D, and here are our R
zeros.
So D can be however long we want it to be. It's just arbitrarily large. R here is of length is three zeros, and then we'll be computing this value, capital R.
So here we go. Here's how it works.
R plus one here is four. Right? There are four bits in the generator. What was the label this thing? So here's how this funny thing works. Look at the first four bits here. G has to start with, or it's not going to actually be a 4-bit number, right? It's shorter number. So it has to start with a 1. If the first four bits here start with a 1, then we write down a 1 over the fourth bit. And then multiply that 1 times this value and write it down underneath.
So this looks like long division. 1, 0, 0, 1. Okay? With me so far?
Now what we do is we don't do subtraction between these, we do XOR on the bit patterns. Okay? So if we do
XOR on those bit patterns, what do we get? We get 0, 0, 1, 0. Right?
All right, and now we drop the first bit. We're guaranteed that the first bit is 0. By the way, we chose to find to write a 1 here only if that first bit was 1. And the fact that that bit was also 1. Guaranteed that the first bit is 0. Okay. Now, looking at this, bring down the next bit.
Again, long division.
Okay. Now we have a 4-bit number, right? But it doesn't start with 1. So in that case, what we do
is we write down a 0. And multiply the 0 times the 1001. And we get 0000. And then we do XOR between those, giving us 100. That one. Oh, see that. Yeah, okay. Where's my eraser? Let's just try this again. Okay, it's a 1 that comes down.
Okay, now I've got a 4-bit number, and
yes, but
it still starts with a 0, so the quotient bit is still 0,
and so I write 1000, and I lose that 1001, and now I can bring down this 0.
Okay. And now this 4-bit number starts with a 1, as does that one, so I write down a 1
in the quotient. Do the multiplication. 1 times 1001. I get 011, and bring down another bit of 0.
Okay.
And since it starts with a 0, I write down a quotient bit of 0. write down all zeros, do our XORing, and bring down another zero. Now it starts with a 1, so I write a quotient bit of 1. 1, 0, 0, 1. Do our XORing and bring down the last 0. It starts with a 1, so we write down a 1. 1, 0, 0, 1. 2, 0, 1, 1. All right. This is the remainder. And it's equal to the checksum. All right. Notice that the quotient is not used. Okay? So that's how it works to compute the checksum. Send, then, is the message, the original message D, 101110, and I follow it by our 3-bit checksum, 011. Okay? This is what is sent. D, R, now, what do you think happens if I divide 10111011 by 1001? Anybody got a guess? That's a good guess. That's what happens, right? So you do that, division, and it would behoove you to do that as a little revisiting of this lecture. Would behoove you to do that. If you do that division, you will find that when you get down to the bottom, that the remainder is 0. Okay? So that's the test that the receiver applies. It just takes what it received, it divides it by the generator using this funny kind of division. If the remainder is 0, it says that was a good message, a valid message. If it's not, then it will reject the message as being invalid. Yeah?
How did you know that straight off the bat without doing the computation?
How did I know that without straight off the bat?
Yeah.
Because the algorithm is designed so that that's what happens.
Okay.
But think about it. So now I'm going to say, forget this fun division.
Okay.
Think about ordinary division. Okay. Suppose you do ordinary division, come up with a remainder, add the remainder to the original number.
Oh. Okay.
What do you get as the new remainder?
Zero.
Right. So the analogy is pretty good. Throughout, it's just that we're doing a funny kind of subtraction here, essentially.
Right, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Sense. Okay? So, that was... I think you saw what that analogy was. That's why we call it the remainder, right? Is because if we add that to the original amount, then we end up with a remainder of 0 when we do it again. Okay, so this may seem tedious and specialized, but I do it in detail because this kind of technique is one that sort of ties your discrete math way back when investigations into sort of real computer science. That's one thing. This CRC algorithm is a computer science classic, and I think every computer scientist should know what it means and how it works.
So I teach you about it. You'll almost certainly never have to implement it, but it's, to me, something that every computer scientist should do. Yes? Yes? If I say every computer scientist should know it, then I think I'm justified in finding out whether you know it or not. Okay? So, yes.
That's the RC. And I think in the exercises for Chapter 5, there are multiple practice problems that have you do this. So just remember that it's not binary subtraction. It's not subtraction of binary numbers. And that's why I wanted to cross out that, treat it as a binary number, because that's not what's going on.
The other thing to say about this is that one of the reasons this got so popular
is that it's possible to implement it in hardware very easily with something called a feedback shift register. You can go look that up. And a shift register is just a bunch of flip-flops into which you feed bits one at a time.
So I feed a bit in here on one clock cycle, and then on the next clock cycle I shift that bit into there and shift the next one in. So that's a shift register.
A feedback shift register has potentially got places in it where the output
is fed back into the inputs of some of the flip-flops, again using XOR, and the result of this thing is that as you shift the message through, what you end up with is the message followed by the checksum, which is pretty cool. All of this complicated stuff about doing long division goes away, and instead we just do this very simple thing.
That was very attractive back in the day when flip-flops were four transistor devices, four discrete transistor devices, and implementing something as complicated as that was not even on people's radar as something you might do in a communication protocol, but the engineers figured out how to do that. Okay? So how? Oh, wrong slides. No wonder. Okay, so that's our checksum, error detection correction. The next thing is, how do we deal with a situation where we have shared media? That is, we have multiple people who might want to talk on a wire over a radio in a room. And come to a conclusion about who has the privilege of talking now, or find a way for multiple talks simultaneously and have other people be able to understand. So, media like that are called broadcast media, and sort of old-fashioned Ethernet is an example like that, of that. Upstream hybrid fiber channel is a variant of cable modems that may be still used, I don't know. Our wireless LANs are certainly examples of media like that. And of course, us talking in the room is an example of media like that. So it's only an issue, right, when there are multiple possible senders who could want to talk on the medium at the same time. So if you have a point-to-point link, I talk to you and you talk to me, as long as we have as long as a full duplex link, we can both talk at once and understand each other. If we can't both, you know, if when you talk you interfere with my talking, then it's more like a broadcast medium. We have this other problem. Okay. So these things are called multiple access protocols. They apply when there's a shared broadcast channel, and we can't tolerate having two people talking at the same time. And a multiple access protocol is an algorithm that the different parties on that shared medium can run in order to figure out who can talk and do so in a way that efficiently uses the channel. And we just, you know, the way this works is we tie our hands behind our backs and rule out certain things that are impractical. So in this case, we're saying we have to design this algorithm so that it works on the same channel that we're trying to share. Right? So we can't say, oh, the way that we solve this problem is we have another channel that we use to figure that out. No, we're going to do it on the same channel that we're trying to share. So what do we want from such a protocol? That's your vocabulary word for the day, desiderata. It means the things that you want, the things you desire. Why that shows up in this slide, I don't know, but it's a good word to add to your vocabulary, so make use of it. Throw it into your next paper that you write and impress your other professors. So what do we want from one of these multiple access protocols? Well, if the channel has a raw capability of R bits per second, then it would be really nice if there's only one node who wants to send, it can send at that full rate, R bits per second. And that would be a good thing. That would be a desideratum. If multiple nodes want to transmit at the same time, then we would like it to be the case that they share fairly. It isn't that one node gets to go at R and everybody else has to be silent. That would not be a good thing. So our desire is that if multiple nodes want to transmit, then they share the available bandwidth. We prefer that there doesn't have to be a specialized node to do the coordination, that somehow it's possible for the individual nodes to figure out when they're supposed to transmit and when they're not. We prefer, but not all algorithms do this, we prefer that we don't have to synchronize our clocks in order to accomplish this. It turns out that synchronizing clocks over even small distances is a difficult problem if they need to be too closely synchronized. And so getting rid of the need to synchronize clocks is certainly desirable, because think about this. Where is this located? This is in the network interface card, right? The network interface adapter. It's one of the less expensive pieces of your computer. So anything that's too complicated is going to drive up the cost of that and make it less desirable. So getting rid of all of this stuff makes it simple, and simple turns into fewer circuits and so on and so forth, fewer algorithms. Okay? Yeah, so how much does an Ethernet adapter cost these days? Well, let me think. Not very much. Right? You can buy a Raspberry Pi Zero for $5 as one of the less capable things on there. There's an Ethernet adapter. So that tells you that the network interface piece of this is down in the range of, what, a few cents, probably. Too much complexity drives up the cost. Although these days we can put an amazing amount of complexity in something that costs $5, because the Raspberry Pi Zero itself has got HDMI video and USB and all kinds of stuff on it that
few years ago, you wouldn't have never thought could be bought for $5. I mean, the HDMI cable costs $5, right? So, kind of shocking. All right. I've blathered on long enough. Next time we'll get into the details of these algorithms.
Is there an email?
Well, I'm hoping for it.
I'm kind of not.
I want to ask you a question.